Billy King. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Jim Mars. And, of course, Jim is going to be with us because there's going to be a conspiracy conference on the 7th and 8th of June, and it's going to be held at the Convention Center at the Marriott Hotel in Santa Clara. And Jim's going to be speaking there along with Joyce Riley and Cliff Cotticorn, Ralph Epperson, Barry Shamus, so many of the people you hear regularly on Radio Liberty. So if you're interested in coming to the conference, well, you should really call Brian Hall. And the telephone number, of course, is 925-449-6844. That's 925-449-6844. But right now, let's go to Jim Mars. Hi, Jim. How are we doing?
Dr. Stan, it's good to be with you.
And I understand that you got your telephones back on. We were a little worried about whether you'd be able to reach us.
I was, too. And I guess I raised enough cane, and they got on it, and they got it going here a couple hours ago.
I'm so glad. Well, it's, we would have taken you on a cell phone because, of course, Jim is one of our favorite guests. He's basically an investigative reporter. He's written a number of books, one of we carry called Rule by Secrecy. And, of course, we've carried his other books as well. But we're going to be talking this evening about a book he wrote called Terror Conspiracy. Goes into the background of what really happened on September 11th. And there's so many things that you've never heard about. And the reason you've never heard about it is because the 9/11 Commission interviewed 1,200 people, only, of course, put their public testimony of 100 of them out and sealed for 50 years the testimony of the other 50 people. Now, pardon me, for 50 years, the testimony of the other 1,100 people. Why would they do that? Because they don't want you to know what happened on September 11th, 2001. So with that as a background, Jim, you pick up the story. You knew immediately after the fall of the Twin Towers and then the fall of Building Number 7 that evening that something wasn't right, didn't you?
That's exactly correct. And the very next day, I posted on my website, jimmars.com, I said, look, this is terrible, but we have to remain calm, cool, and collected, because I said in the past, and I was thinking particularly of the Kennedy assassination, people, the whole public was in such shock that, and information and the news media was, you know, everything was preempted there, and their information and people's witness testimonies coming at you so fast, and, it takes a while for people to sort through all that stuff. And I said, you know, in fact, I distinctly remember President Bush on the evening of September the 11th, 2001, said something to the effect that we must not rest until we find out who's responsible for this crime and see that they're punished. And I agree with him 100%. And that's all I've been trying to do ever since. But immediately, things begin to strike me as peculiar. Within 2 hours of the events, with the Twin Towers collapsing, with the news media all still agog about what's happening, I was forced to go out and take care of some business, and I was listening to National Public Radio, and I did not, I could kick myself.
Hold that thought, we'll be back in just a moment.
All right.
Go right ahead. Go on ahead.
Are we still going?
We're going right. Go ahead.
Okay. I can still kick myself because I did not catch the fellow's name, but I did catch that he was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. So I started paying attention to him. And he said, essentially, this is a whole new ballgame. This is a whole new type of warfare. We must bind the nations together to combat international terrorism. And we're going to have to give up some of our liberties. And we're going to have to do, this is a whole new type thing. I'm going, that's interesting. So I get back home and I turn on television and here's all these other stalwarts of the Council on Foreign Relations. Okay, Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig and Wesley Clark. And you know, if you keep skipping the channels, and they're all on there, and they're all saying the exact same thing. To me, it was like they were reading from the same script. And, of course, by this time, we were being hammered with the idea that this was Osama bin Laden. He did this. He was behind this. And all I could think of was November the 22nd, 1963, when an hour after the shooting, when nobody really knew what had happened, they were already announcing that they had a suspect. He was Lee Harvey Oswald. He did it. He was kind of a nut, and he did it all by himself. And they've tried to stick with that ever since, and today nobody believes it because the evidence has now come out to show that that's simply not true. And so today we have a massive amount of evidence out, and more people. More than 125 ranking military officers now are saying it was an inside job. The whole website's devoted to professional pilots who said they can't do this. They exceeded the design capabilities of those aircraft. It's impossible, okay? A whole website devoted to architects and engineers who go counter to the paid government experts and say, no, there's no way that a steel-reinforced building can simply fall down because of fire or even because airplanes hits it. You may recall, Dr. Stan, I hate to date you, but if you remember, I think it was in the late 40s when the plane flew into the Empire State Building,
right,
up on one of the upper floors. That building didn't fall down, okay? Other planes have hit buildings. The buildings never fell down. In fact, there's never been a steel-reinforced building in the history of the world that's collapsed due to collision or fire. In fact, I would point out that in 2005, early 2005, in Spain, in Madrid, Spain, the Windsor Hotel caught fire, burned out of control for 2 days, and totally gutted this high-rise.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back with Jim Hawkins.
It didn't fall down.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Jim was just commenting that on the very day of the September 11th attack, listening to the radio, he hears some fellow from the Council on Foreign Relations coming on saying we're going to have to change our lives because of what happened today, because of the attack on the World Trade Center. Everything's going to change for America. And he gets home and he listens to the radio, and there's Henry Kissinger and Al Haig and Wesley Clark and other members of the Council on Foreign Relations are saying exactly the same thing. Oh, we're going to have to change our way of life. We're going to have to give up our freedom. And have to, suddenly engage in this war on terrorism to actually, of course, capture the wicked people who brought down the Twin Towers and killed all these 6,000 Americans. They were talking about 6,000 Americans at that time, and of course there were really only 3,000. I don't think that they thought the people were going to get out who worked for Morgan Stanley. There were almost 3,000 people who were told to stay at their desks, and they didn't do it. They got out of the South Tower, and that's why we didn't have 6,000 die. But anyway, as Jim is pointing out, certainly airline pilots, there's an organization, 911 Truth Airline Pilots, and they say those planes couldn't have been flown the way they were by inexperienced people. There's a group called Architects, Architectural Engineers, who say there's no way that those buildings could have come down the way we did. They were told, and besides that, why did Building 7 come down? There are a lot of unanswered questions. And we were immediately told, I'll never forget that day, of course we saw the horror of the buildings coming down, and then immediately we began to see, they showed this picture over and over and over again, of a group of Palestinian children sort of laughing and sharing because this had happened. And I remember that very day feeling, they're preparing us to hate the Palestinians or hate the Arabs because they're responsible for this. Look how happy they are. Why do they keep showing those shots over and over and over again about these Palestinian children? We don't know whether this shot was done. It could have been done weeks before, Palestinian children playing in the streets and laughing.
Dr. Stan?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, let me comment on that.
Okay,
because
go ahead.
That has now been researched. And it turns out, and has been fully documented, that one shot of Palestinian children laughing and jumping up and down was because they were throwing candy to them.
Right.
And that there were hundreds of other shots of Palestinians, Syrians, Saudi Arabians, Jordanians, other Middle Easterns, who were very, very glum and morose and saddened on that day, and who felt a definite sympathy for the people of the United States and what we went through there. And why that particular clip, which was based on throwing candy to children and then watching them jump up and down and smile and laugh, and why that particular clip then was put on corporate major television and shown over and over again is simply an indication of the propaganda that was going on, the very type of propaganda that former Press Secretary Scott McClellan now says was the basis of the Bush administration policy at that time.
What's that old saying about, you know, in war the first casualty is the truth?
Absolutely.
They have to have propaganda to get the people to hate the enemy. After all, if the people don't hate the enemy, they won't want to go out and kill the Japs or the Germans or the Huns or whoever the enemy is. Oh, now the enemy, of course, is the Muslims. We're supposed
right.
to hate the Muslims.
And let's take it a step forward. They even a step further. They cannot put that propaganda out there unless they somehow have control over the media.
Well, I don't think there's any question they control the media. Five mega corporations, AOL, certainly, and then
Time Warner,
and then of course Bertelsmann,
and Disney, and Viacom, and here's the one that gets me: the largest publisher in the English language is Bertelsmann, out of Germany.
Right.
Okay. Whose family, the Mohn family, has owned it since the 1920s, and the Heinrich Mohn, the patriarch of the family, was a supporter of the Nazi SS, and in fact Bertelsmann was the largest publisher for the German Wehrmacht.
I'm not
this
surprised.
Is who's now the largest publisher in the English language and controls such publishing houses as Delacorte and Ballantine, and there's just a dozen of them. Random House, okay, and they're all controlled by this German company.
Right. Well, we got five corporations. They control 90-95% of the media, and anybody who wants to document that in a great book called The New Media Monopoly by Professor Ben Begdaki in the University of California. And that's why, certainly here in California, we have Proposition 98 coming up. Literally every newspaper in California is against Proposition 98, which is aimed at preserving property rights. Every newspaper gets that. Why? You'd think there'd be some division. The same thing with 911. All the newspapers will tell you that the official government story is accurate. It's almost as if they're all under the same control. Go right ahead.
Absolutely. And why would all the newspapers in California be so opposed to individual property rights? And I submit to you it's because this nation today is now under the control of what the mass media has called neoconservatism, or the neocons. But I say what it actually is national socialism. Okay? Because socialists want social programs. They want to take care of them from cradle to grave. One of the biggest social programs in the country today is No Child Left Behind, which is just wrecking our school system. Because let's face it, folks, the idea of No Child Left Behind, who can be opposed to that? And the idea that there are no losers. We don't want to tell any of our kids that they're losers. Boy, that sounds good, okay? But let's face it, if there's no losers, there's no winners, okay? And you've got an homogenized, dumbed-down, homogenized school population. And that's what socialists want. These are social programs. And you can't, and the basis of socialism is government ownership. They don't want private ownership. They don't want private companies. They want social programs that are all administered by some central authority. That is the basis of socialism, and we saw what happened at the extreme of socialism with communism, where just a handful of people run everything. And let's not forget, we've all taught, and this was true, that communist socialism was in a death struggle with Germany, and who was in turn held by national socialism. But they were both socialist programs, okay? So what's the big difference? Communism wanted to go worldwide. National socialism wanted the ascendancy of one national entity, in that case Germany. And today, what have we got today? The new American empire. We are God's gift to the world. We take it upon ourselves to go around and fight, invade other countries that we don't like, and because we have national pride, national honor, national socialism. Now here's the clincher. Dr. Stan, do you recall the acronym for national socialism?
Nazi.
Nazi. These are Nazi ideals that we are playing with here, but they're being covered up and masked by other terms.
That's right. We're bringing democracy to the world. We're bringing freedom to the Iraqi people. Aren't we wonderful? No, that's really, we have an empire. It's about time people begin to understand we have troops stationed in 130 nations throughout the world. We're still occupying Germany 60 years after the Second World War ended. We're occupying Japan 60 years after the Second World War ended. We're occupying South Korea 50 years after the Korean War ended, and we intend to stay in Iraq forever. That's why we're building a 120-acre embassy over there, 120 acres of steel-reinforced buildings, so the people will be safe. Our people will be safe there when the Iraqi people want us to leave, and we're not going to leave. But let's get back to what happened on September 11th and your story, because I think it's so vitally important. You actually had the opportunity to interview a woman who was in the Pentagon after we're told a plane had crashed into the Pentagon. Do you want to tell that story?
Okay. That woman was April Gallup, and she worked at the Pentagon, and she had gone there that morning with her small child, who was about a year or 2 years old. And she actually had stopped in to take her some work, and then she was going to take her child to daycare. And while she was in there, there was an explosion. She was knocked to the floor, almost unconscious. When she came to, her first thought was for her child, of course. She stumbled around. She found his baby carriage, and it was all mangled up, and that really terrified her. She continued to crawl around, and she finally located him, and he was injured. But luckily, not fatally, not critically. So between the two of them, they crawled out the hole in the western wall of the Pentagon. And when they got outside, some time had gone by, the ambulances had already left with more critically hurt victims. And a bystander very thoughtfully said, "Here, I'll take you to the hospital." And he carried them to the hospital. Now, while they were in the hospital, April Gallup told me that she was visited by men in suits who would not identify which government agency they represented, and she thought they were there to question her, to find out what had happened. But it soon dawned on her that they were there to tell her that a plane hit the building, and they kept saying, "A plane hit the building, a plane hit the building." And so I finally looked her right in the eye, and I asked her, I said, "Well, in your crawling around and when you went out through the hole," I said, "did you see an airplane or even any pieces of an airplane?" And she very emphatically said, "No." Okay? And I submit to you, they now say that there's nothing left of that airplane. They cannot or will not show us pieces of the wreckage, because they said there is none, because the plane melted in the fire and liquefied.
And yeah, of course, this woman was able to come out through the hole.
Yeah,
of the
she was able to crawl around in there and come out the hole. Yeah, it's absurd.
Well, of course, was she warned to keep quiet? What actually happened?
Yes. They basically told her not to say anything, but she's a courageous woman, and she's telling the truth, just like so many of those family members.
Hold that thought.
We'll
be back in just a moment. You go right ahead, Jim. You were just saying that, Chris.
Yes, in fact, April Gallup was like so many of the other family members of 9/11 victims who declined to take the government's payoff. See, some of them got upwards into almost into the millions of dollars if they would sign off on an agreement with the government that they would not sue anybody, the airlines, the government, anybody, and that they would not talk about what happened. Only a few of them did not take that hush money. And those are the ones who have been pushing for the truth. And if everyone will stop and think about it, consider this. The day after Pearl Harbor, Congress convened an investigation to find out what had happened. less than a week after the Kennedy assassination, President Johnson convened a commission to look into what had happened. 2 years after 9/11, President Bush was still dragging his feet. He did not want an investigation. And finally, he was pressured into it by these fearless family members of 9/11 victims. And so his first choice for a head of a committee was Henry Kissinger, the architect of our foreign policy for about 30 years, who everyone pretty well understands is responsible for the situation that we were in then and now, and a ranking member of the Council on Foreign Relations.
And the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderbergers and all
and
of the
members of the Bilderbergers.
And of course, Henry Kissinger right now is really agitating to get us into a war with Iran. He is the chief for civilian advisor to the President of the United States, according to Bob Woodward. And every time
he is the chief advisor to John McCain.
Right.
So see, it's just the same old bunch. In fact, Dr. Stan, I'm sure you know, behind Hillary Clinton is the Bilderbergers. Behind Barack Obama is Zygmunt Brzezinski and his son of the Trilateral Commission, and behind John McCain is Henry Kissinger in the Council on Foreign Relations. You can pick A, B, or C, and they're all owned and operated by the same people.
Amen to that. Well, anyway, of course, there were a lot of other fascinating things about what happened on September 11th.
Well, yeah, and let's play detective for a minute,
all
okay?
Right.
We've got a crime. Close to 3,000 people lost their lives. This is murder, plain and simple. It's a conspiracy, okay, because more than one person involved. No lone nut assassin here. There's a whole group of people. So let's take a look at these hijackers. 15 of the 19 hijackers came not from Iraq or Afghanistan, but from Saudi Arabia. Okay, so let's take a look at Saudi Arabia. All right, and now we realize that in 2002, one of their top Al-Qaeda chiefs was captured in Pakistan, Abu Zubaydah. And Ari Fleischer, who at that time was the White House press secretary for President Bush, made a big deal out of that. And they said, we're going to make him talk. Well, they did. They tried torture, but that didn't work very well. So they finally tricked him. And they tricked him into revealing that he was actually working on behalf of three Saudi princes. And that his cutout was the Pakistani Air Marshal Mir. So in other words, the head of Al-Qaeda, one of the heads of Al-Qaeda, says that he's actually working for the Saudi Arabians. You didn't read that in the New York Times, did you? At least not for maybe 3 years later, a little piece appeared. But you didn't see headlines on that. So now we find out that Saudi Arabia...
Hold that thought, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Jim was just saying that we had captured the number two man in Al-Qaeda, and of course, eventually, they were able to trick him, and they tricked him into telling the truth. And what did he say? Why, he was working, here's the head of the wicked Al-Qaeda that, of course, is responsible for the attack on the World Trade Center, and this fellow admitted that he was actually working for three Saudi princes, and his contact man was somebody from a high official in Pakistan. Well, aren't they the organizations, the countries we're working with? Aren't we funding Pakistan with billions of dollars a year? And isn't the Bush family very close to the Saudi Arabians and the Saudi Arabian princes?
Absolutely. And if you, by the way, this is, has anybody thought to question this? When he visited in Saudi Arabia here just recently, President Bush authorized and approved Saudi Arabia developing nuclear capabilities and enriching uranium, the very thing he wants to go to war over against Iran. Now, why would he let Iran, you know, be on the hook and then let Saudi Arabia get by with it? In fact, you know, the one country that has developed nuclear weapons from their nuclear technology and has threatened the United States is North Korea. And yet, in my book, The Terror Conspiracy, Deception 9/11 and the Loss of Liberty, you will find that the person who approved the release of nuclear technology to North Korea that they used to build their nuclear weapons, which they tested and then threatened against the United States, was none other than George W. Bush. And this was in the spring of 2002, long after 9/11.
You know, I think it's really so interesting. If the American people would just go into the background and read over the history of the last 20 years, time and again, the American government has provided, you know, fuel, oil, tremendous amounts of oil, tremendous amounts of food to keep the North Korean government in power. In fact, we just going to send them, I don't know, another 500 million tons of food, something like that. Go up on the Internet and check it out. Time and time and time again, why our government funds this ruthless, communist, brutal government that's supposedly threatening us with the use of nuclear weapons. Now, why would we be funding, and why would we be giving at the present time 500 million tons or whatever it is, I've forgotten the exact amount, but a massive amount of grain and food to the North Korean government to keep the communist government in power? And
a communist government that has actually publicly threatened us with nuclear weapons.
Right. And
well,
same thing.
It doesn't seem, see, none of this stuff seems to make any sense until you understand the secret societies and the wealthy cliques and cabals that are behind the scenes manipulating all of this.
For example,
one thing that has never made any sense to anybody, and of course you don't hear the corporate-owned mass media even talking about it, is that if we're supposed to be so concerned about an international terrorist group trying to bring weapons into our country and destroy our democracy, how come to this very moment nothing substantial has been done to secure the borders of our nation? And the reason, it doesn't make any sense, does it? I mean, if we're in a war on terror and people try to slip in our country, we should have doubled and tripled and quadrupled our border patrols and given them all the tools they need to secure our borders. But none of that has happened because that's not what they really want. What they really want is the North American Union, and you're not going to have a North American Union if you have a distinctive and sovereign Canada and United States of America. In Mexico.
And, of course, the other thing is, if all these terrorists are out there, and we know that they're terrorists, I mean, they're fighting and dying over there in Iraq against fighting against the Americans. They're going in and have their suicide bombers in Israel. If all these terrorists are out there and they hate America, you would think at least one could have snuck into the United States and derailed a train or started a forest fire or done something, poisoned some water, but we haven't had any major terrorist attacks in the United States, you know, for 7 years. How could that possibly be if, of course, we're in a war with terrorism and all of these Muslims hate us?
Well, look how the names have changed. When we entered Iraq, we didn't want to admit that we were fighting the Iraqis because that smacked too much of just an aggression. So they became insurgents. Well, what's an insurgent? Check your dictionary. That's just anybody that fights against the established order. Well, the established order was the U.S. military. So anybody fighting against the U.S. military was called an insurgent. And then finally, after a couple of years, slowly they begin to shift the terms and say that they were fighting Al-Qaeda. You know, well, of course, the Al-Qaeda's made up primarily of Saudi Arabians. They're Wahhabi Muslims, and they are in conflict with both Shiites and the other factions.
Hold on, Phil. We'll be back in just a moment, Jim. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Jim Mars. Jim, you were talking about the fact that I said we're being told a lot of things about what's going on over Iraq today and who we're fighting. And apparently we're fighting the Shias and we're fighting the Sunnis and we're fighting Al-Qaeda. And, of course, Al-Qaeda predominantly made up of Saudi Arabians. But who's providing all the money for Al-Qaeda?
Exactly.
Who's providing the weapons for Al-Qaeda? We know
exactly.
That General Petraeus just accidentally lost what he was in command of training the Iraqi army, 200,000 weapons.
That's
how
right.
Could you lose 200,000 weapons? Who was fired? Who was convicted for that? I mean, who's arming the insurgents? Why?
Nobody.
Sent back most of American arms.
And why, when we invaded Iraq, did we disband the Iraqi army, the only potent force there that was able to maintain law and order? The whole country falls into chaos, and we just sink deeper and deeper into it. And, of course, they keep trying to come out with scapegoats, and they're having a hard time. Here just a few weeks ago, General Petraeus announced they were going to have a press conference, and they were going to show all these weapons that had been slipped into Iraq to fight Americans from our enemy du jour, Iran. Well, it never came off, because when weapons inspectors went in and actually inspected the weapons, they were mostly made in the USA or somewhere else. They didn't come from Iran. So they're having a hard time trying to hold the whole thing together. And now we have people like John McCain who are trying to tell us that we have to stay in there because of our honor. Well, now, wait a minute. The facts, the Downing Street memo, the revelations of Scott McClellan, former White House press secretary, and plus literally hundreds and thousands of other people, clearly show that this war was thrust upon us by propaganda, by lies, by deceit, and this was no mere mistake. This was no bad intelligence, as President Bush would have us think, because I can distinctly remember that Hans Blix, the UN weapons inspector, before we invaded, said they don't have any weapons of mass destruction. And if you don't want to trust the United Nations, then how about our own weapons inspector, Scott Ritter, who publicly was stating they do not have any weapons of mass destruction. But no one was listening to them. They were poo-pooed, and everybody was browbeat by the corporate mass media, and off we go into this whole war that's got us mired down based on lies and deceit and
hold
propaganda.
That
now,
hold
where's
that
the honor? Where's the honor in that?
Well, this is Dr. Stan, because Jim Mars is simply saying we're told that we have to stay in Iraq to defend our honor. But since, of course, as Scott McClellan has pointed out, we were actually taken into Iraq by shading the truth, was the term he used. He said the president didn't lie. He just shaded the truth. Well, I think when you shade the truth, it's a lie, but that's all right. But, of course, what Scott McClellan said, they use propaganda. They use propaganda ahead of time to get the American people to be willing to go to war. So what's new? I mean, they always use propaganda to get us to go to war, whether it's the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, you know, about a non-existent attack on American forces, whether it's the Spanish blowing up the Maine, which they didn't do, get us into the Spanish-American War, whether it was the sinking of the Lusitania, to justify getting us into the First World War. The Germans had said they're going to sink the ship, don't get onto it. It's a ship of war. It's carrying munitions. They ran big advertisements in the paper, and our State Department was telling American citizens, oh, go ahead, take your ship trip over there to England or the Lusitania. There's nothing to worry about. And unfortunately, well over 110 Americans believed the State Department and did not believe what the Germans were saying. We're going to sink the ship, and then they pulled the destroyed escort away from the Lusitania so that it would be sure to, of course, be sunk by the Germans, even in order to go at half speed to preserve coal. We have to preserve coal, slow it down so it would be a better target, and they wanted those people to die to get us into the war. Fortunately, it didn't work. We didn't. That was in 1915. We didn't get in the war until 1917, after another phony issue. But go ahead.
Now, the Zimmerman note.
Right.
But my question is, where's the honor? Well, you know, if we're tricked into a war through lies, deceit, and propaganda, where's the honor in trying to stay there? Let me put it on a kind of a on a down-to-earth level, okay? Let's say, Dr. Stan, that I come to you and tell you that Joe over here has said some very, very nasty things about your wife, okay? So you go over and punch the guy in the mouth, and you deck him, all right? But then you find out that he never said that, that it was me. I made that up because I wanted you to go over there and punch him, okay? Now, what do? Do you keep punching the innocent victim? No, you help him to his feet, and the honorable thing to do is to say, I am so sorry. I was misled. I made a mistake. You know, let's shake hands and let's be friends. That's what it, the honorable thing to do. We should admit that we were just, you know, tricked into this war, and we should, for the safety of our own troops, for honor, and to regain some measure of stature in the world, we should admit to our mistake and leave. Leave their country.
I agree with you, Jim. I think it's a terrible, terrible tragedy what's happened, and a million people have died over there, a million Iraqis, and but nobody's responsible. We've destroyed
nobody's
the Christian population
the
over there.
What the hell is that?
Right.
I can remember after the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, and I could go into great detail about that, but the bottom line is all the Bay of Pigs invasion was planned and produced by Richard Nixon as the White House political action officer under President Eisenhower, okay? And then John Kennedy got elected in 1960, and he was not even informed that there was going to be an invasion until after his election. And then he was told, by the way, this plan's been approved by the previous administration, and everybody's in place, we have all these troops, we got these ships, we got these planes. And so he said, you know, he was presented with a fait accompli, essentially, and he goes, well, okay, but try to keep it very low key. And of course it turned out not very low key, and then it turned into a disaster. Now Kennedy could have been dishonorable, devious, shade the truth, and come on television, tell everybody, well, this was a plan of the previous administration, a Republican administration, and I was kind of forced to go along with it. And he could have laid the blame on them legitimately, but I can still recall President Kennedy coming on the television and saying, this did not end well, but I am the commander, it happened on my watch, and I will take the full responsibility for this debacle. Now that's an honorable person. President Bush has still not taken responsibility for anything. 9/11, his shoddy 9/11 commission, the wars of aggression against Afghanistan, Iraq, it's always somebody else's fault. Nobody has taken responsibility for anything. And it's that's a situation that needs to come to a halt.
Well, I think it's Scott McCullen has done a great job in bringing out the truth, and now he's going to be viciously attacked.
Oh, he already is.
And, of course, because they have to discredit him. In fact, I was reading someplace, they said why Scott McCullen has broken the code of honor by revealing what happened to him.
He's dishonorable.
What a dishonorable man.
The president.
Right.
I mean, it's just incredible. We have got to return to being a moral nation and a nation of laws. And I'll tell you what, and people say, well, Scott McCullen, he's just disillusioned and disgruntled. And I tell you what, it seems to me that Scott McCullen has finally found his conscience.
Well, I think the important thing for our listeners to understand is the Democrats aren't going to get us out of there. I mean, they were elected in 2006 with the idea they were going to force America out of the war.
And
the leaders of the Democrat Party had no intention of stopping the war any more than the leaders of the Republican Party did. And it doesn't matter whether you get Obama or whether you get Hillary or you get McCain. They're all going to continue this war. And until the American people understand that these are simply fronts for the powerful forces work behind the scenes, and you'll learn a lot about those powerful forces if you read Jim Marr's other book, Rule by Secrecy, which we still carry. Jim, do you want to get your website out and any more information for some of your books?
Yes, my website is jimmarrs.com. And I'll tell you what, I think... Let me mention my new book. How much time have we got left?
Oh, we got about 20 minutes or so.
Okay. Let me mention my new book that will be out from HarperCollins at the end of this month, at the end of June. Okay, it's not quite June yet, but almost. And I think this is going to really cause a stir, because Dr. Stan, you, so many of the other Patriot radio announcers and talk show hosts, people in the media, people all across the country, we all know that something has gone fundamentally wrong with this country. But we're not sure who to point the finger at. The Democrats blame the Republicans, and the Republicans blame the Democrats, liberals versus conservatives, neocons versus moderates, whatever, and everybody's pointing the finger, everybody's conflicted. But I can tell you that at the heart of our troubles are Nazis, National Socialists. And these National Socialists now control both the Democratic and the Republican Party. In the Republican Party, it began with a Nazi named Nikolai Malaxa, who was aided by Richard Nixon and John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles in recovering some $400 million that was frozen by the government because of during the war. And Nixon got several $1 million out of that, and that put him on a course to the White House. And he brought with him all of his other little Nazi friends. Those of you out there who are old enough to remember Watergate may recall that Liddy, Halderman, Ehrlichman, all of these guys would sit in the Nixon White House basement and watch Nazi propaganda films. Remember that, Dr. Stan?
Well, I was never invited. Anyway, when will the book be coming out? And
the book, it will be coming out at the end of June, and it will identify who, what, when, where, and how that National Socialism has gained a sway in the home of the brave and the land of the free.
I think the American people, of course, most of them have never heard of Operation Paperclip, where at the end of the Second World War, we brought Nazi war criminals to America to work on psychological warfare, on biological warfare, and, of course, the space program. And, of course, but 10,000 Nazis, some of the most vicious ones. I mean, people like Dr. Mengele and Martin Bormann and Eichmann and Klaus Barbie. I mean, this is war criminals. This was the rat line. They were actually smuggled into South America by the Central Intelligence Agency,
right,
by MI6, and by a clique there at the Vatican, all working together to bring the rat line, these German war criminals, to South America, where they lived out their lives happily. And the average American has never heard that. 10,000 Nazis. Why would our CIA have helped the Nazis escape to South America? Unless, of course, something else is going on.
Well, something else was going on. And in my new book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, you will learn who it is and what they did. And it goes back prior to the war, when the Rockefellers, the Morgans, the DuPonts, the Harrimans, the Bushes, Prescott Bush, all were supporters of Hitler. And they created Hitler. And when it turned that when it became obvious he was going to lose the war, then they brought all these Nazis over here and they imported National Socialism into America. The Germans lost the war. The Nazis did not.
Right, I was just sort of getting into the whole idea of the Odessa file then.
Yes, exactly. But I will give you the names and the dates and the places.
Well, I'm really looking forward to the book, and as soon as it gets out, Jim, be sure I get a copy, and we'll carry the book, we'll get it to our listeners, because behind what's going on today, there are other powerful forces. Now, Jim has written the book, The Rule by Secrecy, which we still carry. It's still a good book, but I'm really looking forward to this next one.
Well, it's an extension of Rule by Secrecy.
Okay.
Because it's the same people.
Okay.
The same groups. And I've brought it right on up to modern times.
And, of course, we're going to try to get copies of Jim's book, The Terror Conspiracy, if we can...
can we get hold of the publisher?
Well, I'm going to. But anyway, somebody just called in and certainly asked you if you had heard anything at all about the fact that they have the ability to control planes, and we're talking about now airliners, by some sort of a computer control so that...
Remote control.
They can
Absolutely. Actually
take control of those planes and take it away from the pilot.
That's right. As far back as the 1980s, among other things, I'm an award-winning aviation aerospace writer, won a National Writing Award for my aviation writing, and as far back as the 80s, I was told by a commercial pilot who flew one of the big wide-body jets that he kind of groused to me one time, and he said, you know, my job's redundant. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, on the new Boeing 757s and 767s, they're all run by computer. He said, I'm just there in case the computer fails. Well, anything is run by computer can be captured by another computer. And this gets into Global Hawk technology, we know that in the early days of the invasion of both Iraq and Afghanistan, we sent Global Hawk remotely controlled pilotless planes, drones, in ahead to spot and use their cameras on gun positions and defenses, and then we'd go in with the fighters and bombers and take them out. Okay, those things are flown from the ground or from another aircraft. And what is absolutely a fact is that any plane flown by computer, that computer can be captured electronically. Okay, it's this may be simplistic, but it's the same principle of a CB radio. If you're talking on CB radio and somebody comes in with a radio signal that's stronger than yours, then you get what they call stepped on, and the person you're trying to talk to hears the other signal rather than your signal. Well, if you put in a stronger computer signal, you can capture that computer electronically, and then you can guide that airplane anywhere you want it to go, regardless of the flight crew, regardless of any hijackers.
Well, you know, one of the big questions about 911 is, why did Building 7 come down? Nobody ever wants to ask that. That came down, at 5:20 that same day, but it wasn't hit by a plane. I mean, no other is a steel reinforced building has ever collapsed that way.
Because 37 story steel and glass building totally dropped at about 5:25 on the afternoon of 9/11.
The real
question is, how did CNN and the British BBC, how did they know to announce the collapse of Building 7 20 to 30 minutes before it collapsed?
And, of course, anybody who's ever seen the pictures, you can see them on the Internet. You simply Google in Building 7 videos, and you'll actually see it. And they have half a dozen pictures of it coming down, but they're also the same thing. If you're going to do a controlled demolition, first of all, you have to take out the central structures of the building that it'll fall inward. If you don't, it'll fall outwards. So if you watch the films, you'll see the center part of the roof cave in, and then the whole base of the building disappears and the building comes down. A very obvious controlled demolition, and nobody ever wants to ask, how did Osama bin Laden get explosives into that building where the FBI, the CIA, and Mayor Giuliani had his headquarters?
Exactly. And speaking of Giuliani, I distinctly recall personally watching him being interviewed as he was covered with debris and dust, and he's coming down the street in New York. And he says, we were in our temporary shelter, and he said, somebody came in and said, you have to evacuate, the Twin Towers are coming down. And he said, we were in the process of evacuating, we didn't even get out fully before the buildings came down. Now, my question is, who told him those buildings were coming down, and how did they know they were coming down, and why didn't they tell the firemen in those buildings?
Lots of unanswered questions. Why have 1,100 bodies never been recovered? And why did a fire burn in the basement of the World Trade Center for 3 months with the heat of a crematorium? And, of course, that's covered in the book, Who Were They?, which is actually written by the medical examiner who identified the DNA, identified the bodies, or at least the bodies they had. But 1,100 bodies, nothing has ever been found of them. Were they, of course, crushed when the building collapsed? Were they vaporized when the building exploded? And if it pancaked, why were there a lot of chunks of concrete? There weren't any chunks of concrete. There wasn't any concrete. It had all been vaporized. How do you vaporize concrete simply when a building pancakes? Nobody's
right.
ever asked
those
questions.
If the building pancakes, it falls over, and as you would expect, you've got a huge pile of rubble. According to the government's own figures, those two 110-story buildings should have resulted in 4.5 million tons of debris that would have stacked up to a height of 10 stories. And yet, according to their same figures, they only carted away 1.5 million tons of debris, which only went up to about 2 stories. So my question is, please explain to me what happened to the other 4 million tons of debris.
Well, we know as we saw...
A building collapsing does not disintegrate.
Right. But, of course, that building did disintegrate.
But
we saw it happen. We're going to be back in just a moment to wrap up the program. Our guest is Jim Marrs, and well, always certainly we're talking about his latest book, The Terror Conspiracy, which we will be carrying. But of course, we're looking forward to his next book on the Nazi movement, which is still alive and well and working at the highest levels of America today. Jim, go right ahead. We got 3 minutes for you to finish up the program.
Well, Dr. Stan, as always, it's good to be with you, and we've covered a lot of ground today. We know that the attacks of 9/11 have not been properly investigated, honestly investigated. The evidence points to an inside job, that people either let it happen or even, God forbid, ordered something like this to happen on U.S. soil just to fulfill their own agenda. And who would do something like that? Well, I submit to you there is one group which today it is still politically correct to vilify and to hate, and that's the Nazis. And I'm telling you, the people at the top of the food chain who are trying to control the United States and, in fact, the whole world today are Nazis, National Socialists, who are trying to bring a National Socialist order to the entire world. And what the game plan is to create the European Union, the North American Union, and the Asian Union, and then play one against the other at all times for maximum profit and control. If you want to know how that works and what life would be like under such a system, just read George Orwell's 1984.
Well, I think that's a pretty good description. In fact, right now they're in the process of forming a South American union. It's going to be, they've already established a central bank, central currency, and all the countries of South America kind of fit into that, and then they can compete with the North American union.
That's right. Then we'll be at conflict with them, and, you know, and wars and rumors of wars and terrorist, you know, alerts, and keep everybody panicky and off base. Listen, what they don't want is something like Franklin Roosevelt said, and look at the difference. Franklin Roosevelt, at the height of World War II, when we truly were threatened by large and very well-equipped armies in Germany and Japan, he said, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Let's put our nose to the grindstone and let's, you know, take care of business. We don't hear that today. Today it's, oh, there's another terrorist alert. Oh, be afraid. Oh, but keep shopping. You know, it's amazing.
Well, we live in exciting times, Jim. We're looking forward to being with you there at the Conspiracy Conference. That's on June 7th.
That's
June
8th. Right. I think I'd like to ask, you know, encourage everybody to come to the Conspiracy Conference in Santa Clara. That's weekend after this one.
The weekend after this one. God bless. Look forward to seeing you there, Jim.
Okay. Good night, Dr. Stan.
Good night. Bye-bye. All right. Bye. That was Jim Marrs. And, of course, we're talking about his book, The Terror Conspiracy, which we will be carrying. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope that you enjoyed our conversation with Jim Marrs. Remember, he'll be speaking at the Conspiracy Conference. That is on June 7th and June 8th, the weekend after next. It's over in Santa Clara at the Marriott Hotel. If you want more information, you're going to have to call the head. Brian Hall is putting that on, and his telephone number is 925-449-6844. That's 925-449-6844. And then, of course, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we've really depended upon those of you out there who loyally support us. And if you're not already a supporter and you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us maintain our network, which now has over 65 outlets every single week, a lot of them weekend programs, only it goes to 35 stations. All across America, tremendous coverage. It's so important that people at least have a chance to hear the truth, because you're not getting it through the regular channels. were involved in the spiritual battle. There are secret societies. There have always been secret societies going back to ancient times. And many of the descendants of those secret societies are working right here in America today, through the Rosicrucians, to the Masons, to the Theosophists, to the people involved with the New Age, through the various secret societies working within our religions today. And believe me, they're working within the Jewish religion, they're working within the Protestant religion, they're working within the Catholic religion, and certainly we saw the head of the National Associations of Evangelical Christians with 30 million members of the National Association of Evangelicals. It just turned out that he was a coke-using homosexual. Now, he didn't get that job there without a lot of help within the evangelical movement in America. They've infiltrated our churches, they've infiltrated our schools, they've infiltrated our government, our media, and, of course, we're in real trouble today. If you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, let me recommend it. Let me recommend Jim Marr's excellent book, which we still carry. It's called Ruled by Secrecy, and another excellent book by our good friend Ted Flynn, The Hope of the Wicked. So those three books will give you tremendous insight into what's going on. The Brotherhood of Darkness, Ruled by Secrecy, The Hope of the Wicked. And then, of course, my talk on the forbidden secret. And it comes with a syllabus. You need to get that to understand that there is a secret that's been passed down for 5,000 years, and it's always been kept secret. Only now, at this time in history, it's being very widely popularized by Oprah Winfrey, by Larry King, by other people within the media. Why, at this time in history, are they letting the secret out of the proverbial bag? Well, of course, you'll want to get my talk, The Forbidden Secret, because we will tell you what this is really all about. And then the syllabus that goes with it. And then our talk on the planned police state, which we highly recommend, along with the syllabus, because there you'll actually get some of the writings from the other side. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the other side does put out publications, and certainly they actually talk about the spiritual hierarchy that rules the world and how they're working within finance, both in the East and the West. Or, in other words, in communist countries and in the Western European and American societies. Understand that there are powerful forces out there. Some of the most wealthy people in the world are involved in this. People who have sold their souls for wealth and prosperity and power. And if you have not yet seen the DVDs, They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, deals with the music industry, but many of the leading performers of today have made a pact with the devil. Well, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. If you want to get the DVDs, They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, they come in 3-hour, 4-hour, or 10-hour versions. And if you watch any one of those, it will change the way you look at the world, and you suddenly begin to understand what we're up against. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. It's on our webpage, RadioLiberty.com, where you can listen to our programs 9 hours a day. Please pray for America, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of one of our favorite guests, and that's William Grigg, formerly the senior editor of the New American magazine, and now a freelance writer, certainly doing a great deal of work and writing and working with the Welch Foundation. And, of course, he's good enough to come on with us twice a week here. And this is the Friday evening time when we talk to William Grigg. William, how are you tonight?
Dr. Stan, I'm doing very well, and I really appreciate you having me on again.
Well, what are we going to be talking about tonight?
I wanted to talk in general terms, first of all, about this whole concept of conspiracy. And the irony, this is something I think we touched on before, that our entertainment, our literature, our television programs, our movies are replete with talk about conspiracy. Whether you're talking about standard crime fiction, where you have such terms as accomplice and getaway car and other parts of vocabulary that make no sense at all unless you're talking about a plot, whether you're talking about primetime television, where you have police procedurals and other programs that always involve some kind of a criminal conspiracy, often with political coloring, or whether you're talking about movies. How familiar are you, if you're familiar at all, Dr. Stan, with the writings of Dean Koontz?
I really don't know him at all.
Yeah, he's one of the best-selling novelists in the country, probably up there with John Grisham and Tom Clancy, and his books are, of course, available in every airport bookstore as an impulse buy. People will buy them in order to distract their attention while they're confined in an airplane for a couple of hours. Last year, he put out a perfectly wonderful novel by the name of The Good Guy, and it's a really engaging thriller, a crime story, but it involves, at the end of the book, pulling the curtain away a little bit to talk about the shadow government that exists. The plot involves this man who ends up getting involved in a self-appointed mission to protect a woman who's been targeted by a contract killer. He got sucked into this plot because he was mistaken for the contract killer when somebody showed up with an envelope full of money and a photograph of a woman who was targeted for execution, and then the contract killer showed up, and he tried to cancel the contract. The main character, his name is Tim, tried to cancel the contract, but he ends up protecting this woman and being pursued by this implacable contract killer who has access to resources the likes of which this man simply can't understand. The contract killer supposedly was a bad cop, but he was connected to people who could keep Tim and Linda, the targeted woman, under constant surveillance. And at the end of the book, after Tim has finally managed to dispatch the villain, he meets the people the villain works for. And one of them, a fellow by the name of Mr. Wentworth, delivers this remarkable soliloquy. And Mr. Wentworth says to Tim, "Our country, Tim, must make certain concessions. We cannot be what we once were. In the interest of prosperity, there must be less of it. Too much freedom assures less peace." To which Tim responds, "Try selling that at the ballot box." And Wentworth, without skipping a beat, says, "We do sell it, Tim, by inciting false fears in the people. Remember Y2K? All computers would crash at the stroke of midnight. The collapse of high-tech civilization. Nuclear missiles would launch uncontrollably. Thousands of hours of TV news and uncounted miles of newsprint sold the Y2K terror." "It didn't happen," replies Tim. "That's the point," continues Mr. Wentworth. "For a long time now, has not the news been nothing but doom? Do you think that just happens? Electric power lines cause cancer. But of course they don't. Most everything you eat will kill you, and this pesticide, and that chemical. But of course people lead longer and healthier lives decade by decade. Fear is a hammer. And when the people are finally beaten into the conviction that their existence hangs by a frayed thread, they will be led where they need to go." And Tim asks, "Which is where?" And Wentworth replies, "To a responsible future in a properly managed world."
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg. Go right ahead, William.
Well, this whole talk about a responsible future in a properly managed world, of course, made me think instantly of the Earth Charter, and the whole movement behind the Earth Charter to regiment all of human society, all of human civilization, in the name, supposedly, of providing a sustainable future for the environment. And the Earth Charter and the movement that grows out of the Earth Charter of what's called sustainable development would encompass literally every human activity. It would encompass what we do, where we go, how we get there, the modes of transportation we would use, the food we would be permitted to eat, the number of children we would be permitted to have, if we're allowed the luxury of having any. It would define where we would live, the type of housing we would live in, the type of entertainment we would be permitted to watch. In other words, you could round up to everything, the things that would be controlled by these people who would bring about this reconstruction of human society, which is another word used by this enigmatic Mr. Wentworth. And Tim, of course, when he heard this line, responsible future, visibly grew disgusted, and Wentworth continued implacably, "The people elect mostly fools and frauds. When the politicians make policy that leads this country toward the needed reconstruction of its systems, they can be supported. But when they make bad policy, they must be sabotaged at every turn from within." Then talking about this group, which earlier on in the book was referred to as the Gentleman's Club, Wentworth says, when Tim asks if he means that there's a shadow government operating behind the scenes, Wentworth replies, "Yes, we thrive in bureaucracies, in law enforcement agencies, in the intelligence community, in Congress." And he says, "Now the opportunity exists to extend our reach into the Oval Office." And that was the plot that was uncovered innocently by this woman who was being protected by Tim, the main character. She just happened to be at the wrong coffee shop at the wrong time when photographs were taken that ended up on the Internet that compromised somebody, this gentleman's club, this shadow government, this cabal, had anointed as a future president of the United States, and so everybody in the coffee shop had to be killed. I hope I'm not spoiling the book for anybody who hasn't read it yet. Everybody in the coffee shop had to be killed, including people who just might innocently mention something that they had seen that day. And toward that end, the coffee shop was burned down, and the owners were killed, and then one by one, the people who had been there on that particular day were hunted down and killed by this individual that was the main antagonist in the book. And this Wentworth character talked about the fact that there were multitudes of people like this nameless individual who was a programmed and perfectly merciless nihilistic killer. And that reminded me a little bit of the schematic described in Mr. Perkins' book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. We'll be right back with William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is certainly describing the plot of this book, which, of course, really is, of course, that there is this conspiracy that dominates literally every aspect of our society. And the reason, of course, that this woman was being tracked down was that she'd been inadvertently in a coffee shop one morning when something happened. What it was, I'm not sure, but everybody in the coffee shop, the owners of the coffee shop, they all had to be silenced for fear that they would reveal what they might have seen, whether they realized it was significant or not. So reminiscent, for instance, of the Kennedy assassination, where over 100, I think, and 10 mm-hmm. or 120 people were systematically hunted down and killed because they'd just been standing there close to the grassy knoll, close to the place where Kennedy was killed, but they all knew something and they had to be removed. This happened in real life, of course, when Monica Lewinsky was trying to frighten one of the people who was going to testify against Bill Clinton. She gave her a list of 50 people who had been killed because they had certainly spoken out against Bill Clinton. And I'm sure that the name of a lot of the names on that list would be familiar with you, would be familiar to people. This is the way the world really runs today. It's not imaginary. When you can get into a war, as we have in Iraq, and a million civilians are killed, certainly they're not all killed by Americans, they're killed by certainly strife between Al-Qaeda and the Shias, and between the Shias and the Sunnis, and between the Americans or the Shias, the American forces and the Sunnis. But a million people have died because we went into Iraq because of false information. Nobody's been punished. Nobody's been demoted. Nobody's responsible. A million people are dead, and where is the outcry from the American people? But you go ahead, William. You're talking about this idea of conspiracy.
Well, the thing that I find really compelling about this is the fact that Mr. Kuntz, who's got a very long very successful career as a novelist. He started out writing science fiction, hard science fiction, usually involving alien invasion plots, and for that he branched off into horror fiction of the Stephen King variety. And now he's writing these crime thrillers, and they almost always involve some deeper conspiratorial setting or some contemporary allegory that's really compelling. Mr. Kuntz sells millions and millions of books, and people read his books voraciously, and these books are written for the purpose of getting people to think about what's below the skin of the events that take place in our time. The books almost always have some kind of a strong spiritual subtext, and sometimes they're very overtly Christian. They're very free, for the most part, of vulgarity. There was no profanity in this book. There were some vulgar expressions that were situationally predictable and appropriate, but the Lord's name was never taken in vain anywhere in the book, which is really quite a remarkable accomplishment for something that's being put up by our contemporary publishing industry. But the thing is, people read these books by the millions, or millions of people read these books, rather, and very little thought is given to the fact that what he's describing is demonstrably real. If you have an eye to see what's going on in contemporary society, everything he's talking about is going on. The fact that he talked about this schematic where you have this elite organization, the inner sanctum of which is composed of people who are apparently very genteel and cultivated, and then you have these concentric circles that grow a little bit broader, and then under these circles you have this apparently limitless supply of these jackal-type hitmen, men of blood, men of violence, who kill with impunity and are completely protected until they are no longer useful. That's something that was talked about in that book by John Perkins, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, where he talked about the fact that he worked for the World Bank and for the International Monetary Fund as somebody who was recruited through the National Security Agency and worked for a corporation that was attached to this apparatus that was called Charles Bain Incorporated out of New England. And he would go into countries and sell to their ruling elites these extravagant loans that, of course, these governments could never repay. That was the intention. It was to get them hooked on debt so that in process of time, the World Bank or the very various organs of the banking system could effectively foreclose on these countries and extract concessions from them in terms of natural resources or manpower or anything else that would be of use to the global power elite. And the way that the world works, according to Mr. Perkins, whom I interviewed very briefly a couple of years ago, and I think you're probably very familiar with him. I'd be surprised if you weren't.
Oh, we've got a wonderful four-tape set of my interviews with John Perkins.
Fascinating guy. One of the things that I thought was interesting was the way he said that you send in the economic hitmen, and then when people don't cooperate, you send in the jackals. And the jackals, of course, are hired killers. They're people who are cunning in the ways of assassination, and they can remove heads of state, they can remove recalcitrant members of parliaments or members of cabinets. People who are in various financial callings in various governments are susceptible, of course, to the predations of the jackals. And he gave some examples in his books. He's published, or he's written one, he's published a number of others talking about the same subject. And if jackals don't work, then you send in the bombers, you send in the soldiers, and you remove the government by force of arms. That's, of course, what's happened in Iraq, where they removed a former asset of the power elite, Saddam Hussein, somebody who was very lavishly underwritten by both Washington and Moscow during the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and part of the 90s. But that's exactly the same type of a situation Dean Koontz was talking about in fictional terms. The other thing I thought was interesting was his treatment of the psychology of fear and the manipulation of mass passions and the way that fears are generated, cultivated, and exploited by the people who control this illusion-generating machinery that we call the major media. Just a couple of days ago, Newt Gingrich, who's somebody who's sort of an outer-porch member of this elite we're talking about, was caught on film, and the clip has made its way through the Internet, talking about how lamentable it was from his point of view that the Bush administration didn't permit some terrorist attacks to occur after September 11th, just occasionally as a reminder to the public that they need to submit to what Bush and his handlers are doing through the federal government to regiment our society and to keep us involved in these costly imperialist wars overseas. And this is something that I'm surprised Newt Gingrich would say so glibly, but I figure he probably assumes nobody's really paying that much attention to what he has to say. But that's a perfect example of what we're talking about. That, of course, is very much of a piece with what you can read about in some of the esoteric literature that was pried out of the power elite in the early 60s, such as World Effectively Controlled by the United Nations, Lincoln P. Bloomfield's study, talking about the use of various threats to railroad people into accepting a new global architecture where the United Nations would disarm everybody but those who would be carrying out the edicts of the Security Council, or that you'd have a successor organization to the UN that would do the same thing. And of course, Operation Northwoods, the whole program that was conceived in the early 60s through the Pentagon to create these various crises involving contrived terrorist attacks in order to provide pretext for war against various countries. It's all the same psychology. And here just this last week, at a book signing, Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, somebody who mused about and discarded the possibility of offering himself as a gift to the Republic as a presidential candidate, talking about how it would be worthwhile if every once in a while the administration, the President of the United States, whoever it might be, would permit terrorist attacks to occur, presumably involving the loss of life as well as property, simply as a way of goading the public into accepting the bit that our masters want to shove in our mouths. You know, that's very much the same psychology that Dean Koontz is writing about in this fiction. And I don't know what it is about people that they can accept as fiction something that is so readily identifiable as the reality that exists, that is around us. And why it is that people, as a way, as a matter of the discretionary use of their time and money, will immerse themselves in this literature and this entertainment that really has a lot to offer them if they would pay more attention to what's really going on in the news and what's going on in the world around them. It really is quite a source of frustration to me.
Well, I certainly agree with you. I think that our job is to make people understand that what Koontz is talking about is reality of what's actually going on today. There really is a group, as it was described, and of course they really do have this power, and they really are quite willing to kill people in our country if they certainly know too much. And I have actually had at least three of the people I've interviewed who have died. In fact, one of them is a fourth one. His body recently washed up on the beaches in the Caribbean. His name was Chick Tatum. He was a CIA assassin. He was supposed to kill Ross Perot during the 1988 election, and he wouldn't do it. And as a result, he paid with his own life.
I hadn't been aware of the fact that he'd come to an apparently violent end recently.
Right.
How recently did this take place?
Oh, well, Ted Gunderson told me that within the last month or so, that it happened probably within the last 4 or 5 months.
Yeah, I hadn't heard about that.
But you did. You knew who Chip Tatum was.
Yeah, I'd heard the name. And
right.
Talking about what happened in the village of the 92 election and how... Well, Ross Perot is somebody who's always been sort of a problematic figure. I know that there had been an attempt to recruit him into the CFR. That was something that was disclosed in a very brief item, I think, on the front page of the Wall Street Journal back in 91. And I remember when he started talking about these various plots to disrupt his daughter's wedding and things of that sort, people looked at him as if he had been either too loosely or too tightly wrapped. But he's somebody who had demonstrated on more than one occasion the ability to marshal his resources to do things that would be a little bit problematic for the people who are running things. And the fact that he had made a very lucrative living as a defense contractor meant that he was probably very well aware of who some of the major players were, so it wouldn't surprise me at all if we finally at some point get full disclosure about what happened in 1991-92, that there were a number of really nasty things that were planned for Ross Perot if he proved to be an asset that they couldn't fully control. But that's very typical of the way that the political machinery run. Somebody who proves to be effective and troublesome can expect either to be demonized and ostracized and expelled or outright eliminated.
It's unfortunate, but this is the reality of what really goes on in the world today, and until the American people understand that, nothing's going to change. Well, and we're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Mr. William Grigg. But ladies and gentlemen, there really are secret organizations out there that have a different agenda, and their loyalty is not to America, but to the idea of a new world order, and a new world religion, and a new world leader. Go right ahead, William.
You know, there's a subtext, or rather a dramatic device in this novel, The Good Guy by Dean Koontz, involving the use of very sophisticated internet surveillance and wiretapping technology to keep track of Tim and Linda as they flee this killer who is trying to track them down and eliminate Linda. And one thing I thought was interesting is the fact that at one point in the novel, one of Tim's associates, who's a police detective, is trying to find out who it is who's pursuing these two. And as he's working in his house one night on the internet, suddenly his cable service cuts out. His cable service cuts out, which means he can't use his high-speed internet. And within a couple of minutes, he gets a phone call from a masked telephone number. There's an unknown caller on his caller ID. And he doesn't answer the phone, and within another 5 minutes, his supervisor from the police department is on the line asking what he's up to and suggesting that maybe he ought to drop it. And the thing that I find interesting about that, of course, is that if you take a look at the roots of the internet, it all was meant to be a system, a computer communication system, to be used in the event, for instance, of a nuclear war or other wide-scale communications breakdown that the Defense Department, the so-called Defense Department, we haven't had an agency of the government in charge of defense since the War Department was renamed the Defense Department. It was called the War Department. It's actually involved more frequently in defense than it is today, but that entity that calls itself the Defense Department was pretty much the entity that created the Internet. And just in the last week or so, we've seen once again where there are efforts being spoken of to regulate, regiment, and to cleanse the Internet of things that are considered to be troublesome. Joseph Lieberman, who's one of the most repellent public figures I can think of, has been putting pressure on Google and on YouTube, Google being, of course, the world's biggest and most effective search engine on the Internet, and YouTube being owned by Google now, a file-sharing site that has revolutionized the use of the Internet and revolutionized media, quite frankly, to remove a number of videos that Joseph Lieberman said promoted terrorism. And within a few minutes, this was done, or not a few minutes, within a few hours of receiving the letter from Joseph Lieberman, despite the fact that it violated their terms of service agreement with their users and contributors, YouTube removed those videos. And now Joseph Lieberman is sponsoring congressional action, not yet legislation, but action, to examine the supposed need to crack down on file-sharing sites that Lieberman considers to be deleterious to the war on terror. And this is interesting for a couple of reasons, the first of which, of course, is that YouTube and a number of other sites that promote file-sharing, Red Lasso is one, and LiveLeak, there are a number of them, have been very useful as what the dissidents in the Soviet Union used to call samizdat. That's a Russian term that broadly translated means unofficially sanctioned communication. In the old Soviet Union, if one person had a mimeograph machine, one of those hand crank mimeograph machines, he could turn out literature to be passed from person to person in Soviet Russia as a way of getting around official censorship. And that's how a number of really good writers, I mean, we all know about Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and there are others of a similar stature, who saw their first publicity through samizdat, through things that were simply hand-copied or typewritten, and then mimeographed and sent around in an underground literary environment.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back with William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, William is expressing concern because Senator Lieberman, a good friend of John McCain's, Senator Lieberman wants to begin limiting access to the Internet, and of course, he had actually sent threatening letters to YouTube demanding that certain sites be removed. Apparently they were. But the last thing, of course, that the establishment wants is for free communication in America. Certainly the Internet has given us the ability to get out information that we could never have gotten out before, and millions of Americans are beginning to realize that there really is a conspiracy, and the nature of this conspiracy and its spiritual origin, and the people on the other side, Senator Lieberman among them, does not want the American people to hear the truth. So in the name of fighting terrorism, why, we've got to do something about these terrible websites that are contributing to terrorism. well, actually, of course, they're not contributing to terrorism. They're simply telling the truth about the fact that the war on terrorism is as phony as a $3 bill.
Exactly.
We're not fighting terrorism at all. We are using the threat of terrorism to take away the freedom of the American people. And pick that up, William.
That's exactly what's happening here. And, of course, that deals with the this whole psychology of manipulating people's impressions and engendering fear and exploiting fears. And I've been talking about how in the former Soviet Union, because censorship was so unyielding and so comprehensive, about the only way that people could really find out what was going on and have contact with writers who would dissent from this official, this ubiquitous official line, was through samizdat, unofficially sanctioned communication and publication. And that's how writers like Alexander Solzhenitsyn and Vladimir Bukovsky first became significant figures, was because their writings, either handwritten or typewritten, were being circulated by way of mimeograph machines and things of that nature. And then, of course, they were smuggled out to the West and then published as fully realized books. Well, YouTube and file sharing sites on the Internet today are the contemporary digital age equivalent of samizdat. And they're really undermining the monopoly of the mainstream media, because people who have digital cameras, and any up-to-date cell phone is going to have a digital camera in it. Any cell phone worth having is going to have a digital camera. They can actually find out what's going on, and they can undermine the dominant narrative, which is the whole point of unofficial communication. And I really believe it's that function of the Internet that the likes of Joseph Lieberman are trying to contend with and trying eventually to criminalize. There's a piece, interesting enough, from an Internet site called Huffington Post that gives a brief overview of what Lieberman's up to. Last week, Senator Joe Lieberman took another step backward in America's war on terrorism by demanding that YouTube censor hundreds of videos allegedly posted by Islamic terrorist groups. And when the Google-owned video site responded by promptly removing a large number of those videos, which violated its guidelines against content containing hate speech and violence, he insisted that action was not enough. What would be enough, in the senator's estimation? Simply the removal of all the tainted videos, even those that were plainly constitutionally protected advocacy, albeit abhorrent, and a plan to prevent the content from reappearing. While it is hard to disagree with the senator's sentiment that protecting our citizens from terrorist attacks is a top priority of our government, it's equally hard to find anything else in his breathtaking letter with which to agree. Civil liberties continue to be an ongoing casualty in our efforts against terrorism, with our Fourth Amendment rights to privacy taking the greatest hit. But so far, broad censorship of the Internet has not taken root as a viable anti-terrorism strategy in the United States. But censorship is exactly the path we would take if Google, or for that matter, any site that posted user content, acceded to Lieberman's demand that content be reviewed before posting. It would not only violate free speech, it would stop the Internet in its tracks. There are thousands of videos posted on YouTube alone each day, and many more on similar user-driven video sites throughout the Internet. U.S. law wisely provides protection from liability if content that is posted turns out to be illegal. The system we have devised, in which online services establish rigorous terms of service and enforce them against the users, is a wise one. Users help police the system, and sites that are notified of potentially offensive content generally review the material against the terms of service and take down content that violates the rules. In the spirit of such self-policing, Lieberman's request to review specific videos is a fair one, but demanding ongoing review of all videos and removal of those that don't meet with self-selected criteria crosses the line. What these authors are pointing out is that there is a heuristic mechanism in these file-sharing sites already. The rules are plainly posted. You can't steal from people, for instance. If you're dealing with copyrighted material, you can't steal it. And if it's up, up there briefly, and then it's taken down. The system polices itself very well. That's not what Lieberman is interested in. What Lieberman is interested in, of course, is to have prior restraint of those types of advocacy that he and like-minded people in Washington would find objectionable. For the most part, the type of videos and documents that criticize and dissect the foreign policy of the United States. And, of course, I can't help but think that Lieberman, who is awfully tied with the people in the Homeland Security apparatus, eventually would like to see videos documenting police abuse being taken down.
Hold on. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening is William Grigg. And, of course, he's just pointing out that Senator Lieberman, who is a very, very close friend of John McCain, has said that he seems to be very intent upon policing the Internet to protect us from those wicked terrorists who are showing things inappropriate. But then, of course, where do you stop? If you're going to take down the terrorists, website, what about perhaps the John Birch Society or the Wealth Society or the conservatives of the Federalist Party, or certainly what about perhaps the Constitution Party website? They're critical of the government. The Libertarian website, certainly what about Ralph Nader? Maybe we ought to outlaw him. Mm-hmm. Maybe the only candidates we should really have those established by the Council on Foreign Relations and their subsidiary organizations. That way we wouldn't have any conflict, and everybody, especially Senator Lieberman, would live happily ever after. Go right ahead, William.
What you touched on briefly when you mentioned the fact that Lieberman and John McCain are very close is the fact that they have an affinity here, a mutual affinity, for censorship. And McCain, of course, is the McCain half of the McCain-Feingold so-called campaign finance reform law, which is nothing more or less than an attempt at content-based censorship of specifically political speech during a critical period before the election. In other words, those critical weeks immediately before an election when most people are finally paying attention to the political process, finally involved in that process and trying to make some critical judgments about people for whom they'd vote or against whom they'd vote, during that specific window, the McCain-Feingold bill essentially can be used to criminalize certain forms of political advocacy.
And, of course, this was sold, of course, on the idea that it was going to stop lobbyists and, of course, political contributions.
Exactly.
And it was, supposedly, we've got to clean up the political system. We've got to stop all this contribution to political candidates to buy their votes. And that was what it was about at all. It was really about silencing people like you and me who want to get the information out. And, of course, the illegitimate contributions continue. I mean, we're talking about really hundreds of millions of dollars being contributed to the political candidates to buy their political support, including a great deal of money that's given to Senator John McCain and Senator Feingold to buy their support. What they really want, of course, is not to stop the illegitimate contributions. They wanted to silence the dissent.
Matter of fact, Russell Feingold does know better. I interviewed him, I think it must be almost 14 years ago now, 13 years ago, in 1995, following Oklahoma City. He was one of the few people to speak out against the Clinton counterterrorism bill. And in spite of the fact that he's a liberal and statist Democrat, Feingold had some very clear-headed and principled things to say in opposition to the Clinton counterterrorism bill, which was sort of a foreshadowing of what we saw with the Patriot Act. And, you know, Feingold was opposed to the Patriot Act and opposed to a number of other things that are court can settle things. So you have George W. Bush committing an impeachable offense by signing into law something he knows is facially unconstitutional in a signing ceremony that was almost completely devoid of all the familiar pomp and ceremony. Nobody was on hand. There were no photographers present. Nobody was there to receive any of the dozens of ceremonial gift pens that are handed out. It was something that was done in the dead of the early morning as anonymously as possible. because they knew they were doing something shameful. And Mr. Bush admitted when he signed McCain-Feingold that it was unconstitutional, but he left it to the Supreme Court to figure things out.
And then the Supreme Court said it was constitutional, and now we're stuck with a non-constitutional bill. But before we go on, William, I want you to get your blog site out and let people know how to get in touch with you and with your the material that you've written.
I appreciate that. Give it out before Mr. Lieberman criminalizes it. My blog is called Pro Libertate. That's a Latin phrase. It means for freedom. I am, by my own happy admission, utterly obsessed with the question of human freedom. And I try to write a fully realized work of what I call investigative polemics between 3 and 5 times a week. That's a 1,200 to 2,000 word essay. And of course, because of the way the internet works, you can use hyperlinks to document most of the really contestable things. And so, I try to do that as my schedule permits. Usually that means every other day you're going to find something new from me in my blog. The easiest way to find it is to go to the website of the Welch Foundation, which is called The Right Source. And the web address for that is www.rightsourceonline.com. Once again, that's one word, rightsourceonline.com. At the top of that web page, you'll find a banner ad for my most recent book, Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. You can click through in order to order that book, which is also available through Radio Liberty and Amazon.com. And then if you scroll down the front screen, the first page of the Welch Foundation website, you look at the left-hand side of the page, the left-hand side of your screen, you'll find my photograph, and there's a hyperlink that will take you to my blog, Pro Libertate. And if you want to go to it directly, those in the listening audience who want to go to it directly, you can either simply Google Pro Libertate, and I'm pretty sure that my blog will be one of the first hits that would come up, or you can go directly to it by typing freedominourtime.blogspot.com. That's one word, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. That'll take you right to my blog.
All right, go right ahead.
Well, talking about the McCain-Feingold travesty, it's interesting how a number of advocacy groups who had been involved in publishing critical voter guides of incumbent candidates filed amicus curiae or friend of the court briefs in opposition to McCain-Feingold. And one of the first efforts to regulate campaign-oriented political speech way back in the 1970s ended up in a lawsuit in federal courts against the TRIM program of the John Birch Society. TRIM, Tax Reform Immediately, was an ad hoc committee in every congressional district that well, not every one, but the aspiration was to have them in every congressional district. But in many congressional districts across the country, you had these ad hoc committees that were organized through the John Birch Society to distribute bulletins that were voter guides with respect to spending issues. And the logic was to show the members of every congressional district, the voters, rather, in every congressional district, what their member of Congress was costing their individual households by virtue of his voting record. And so if you had a congressman who's voting for a smaller and less expensive government, he was assigned a star. There was a brief description of the vote that would be used as a way of tallying the score. And if he was somebody who voted for a larger and more expensive government, he was given an X. And this is a very effective way of letting each household in the given congressional district know what it costs to be supporting socialist, interventionist, welfare state government. The same votes were used for every congressman. There was no playing around to try to find votes that made Republicans look good and Democrats look bad or the reverse, because party affiliation wasn't published in the TRIM bulletins. They're simply put out as a way of telling people in an even-handed fashion how much their congressman was costing them. Well, this was challenged in court under an earlier campaign finance reform law, and TRIM, of course, emerged victorious, but not unscathed, because this, of course, is a very expensive proposition to be defending your rights in court. So it was clear that with respect to the logic of McCain-Feingold, that if you cannot distribute voter guides within a certain radius of time surrounding an election, the purpose of that measure is not to keep the big money out of politics because the big money flows unimpeded, as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, is to protect the incumbents. And McCain cheerfully admitted on, I believe it was Meet the Press back in 1997 when he was, he'd been promoting this for a long, long time. It obviously was a labor of some interest to him. He cheerfully admitted that he wanted to promote good political speech, and he defined good political speech as speech that avoided the excesses of criticizing incumbents like himself. So this is something that he was on the record admitting. And it's interesting to me to see that you no longer have the TRIM programs, the John Birch Society. I mean, from my, I don't remember exactly the circumstances under which TRIM was discontinued, but it had a lot to do with McCain-Feingold, the idea that you find yourself rather vulnerable to some kind of a Federal Election Commission enforcement action that could end up in court with all the associated costs and trouble and terror that federal court conflict creates. And so you no longer have the TRIM bulletin program being used by the John Birch Society, and there are other organizations that have had similar problems. And it's a pretty good example of how speech suppression works here in the name of campaign finance reform. You protect the incumbents, and you punish those who criticize the incumbents. And I suspect that Mr. Lieberman, who very well might end up as a bipartisan running mate for John McCain, assuming, of course, that McCain ends up securing the nomination, as appears he will, for the Republican Party, Mr. Lieberman is a Democrat, very well could be his running mate. That would be interesting, not entirely unprecedented, but would be an interesting configuration. There's not really a whole lot of philosophical separation between the two of them. It wouldn't exactly be a balanced ticket. But Lieberman is proposing, I believe, a process that would eventually lead to the Internet being governed by similar strictures here, because I honestly think that one of his objectives ultimately is to use the power of government and the intimidation factor that the potential of lawsuits represents to get these file-sharing sites to stop distributing videos that undermine the official government bipartisan consensus, and to stop undermining the narrative that the Homeland Security State is writing for us. One of the things I mentioned before in an earlier break, Dr. Stan, was the fact that YouTube and Red Lasso and LiveLeak and other file-sharing sites have been very good at documenting and disseminating information about abuses of police power. They've made visible something that people knew was going on, but didn't really appreciate in terms of its near ubiquity, and that is the corrupting influence of federal money, the corrupting influence of political, politicized, I should say, police agencies throughout the country in terms of the behavior of the new breed of law enforcement officers we're dealing with. Things have changed dramatically on that front just in the last 15 or 20 years. And so when you have really egregious examples of the needless use of tasers, for instance, against non-resisting subjects, or you have police officers who are with SWAT teams carrying out various dubious missions, doing things that that really look bad and convey to people a sense of immediate, visceral danger that our abhorring police state represents to their liberties. This is something YouTube has been very effective doing, but I suspect that's going to be something targeted by Joseph Lieberman as well. And, of course, you don't have to go to a meeting anymore, much less to a theater, in order to see a very effective presentation of revisionist history or revisionist opinions on what's going on with respect to the whole war on terror and other government programs. YouTube and other file-sharing sites have been wonderful instruments for disseminating what is dismissed as conspiracy-mongering analyses of current events, and because this is a genuinely free marketplace of ideas. As I pointed out earlier when I was reading this piece from the Huffington Post, this is a mechanism that really corrects itself. If you play by the rules, if you're not stealing somebody's copyrights, if you're not doing something that violates the terms of your user agreement, it's a free market. If you don't do any of these things, the chances are that your videos will be up there and they'll be viewed by as many people as you can attract. That's the way the marketplace of ideas is supposed to work. Now you have Lieberman coming in and saying, well, no, this doesn't work adequately because we have to make sure that there's a political surcharge imposed on ideas that we find unacceptable. And so that's something that I think is going to become a really big issue, not just this year, but probably in the years to come now, because I really think that you cannot have the type of state that's being fastened down on us coexisting with the genuinely unregulated internet. China's, of course, got all kinds of means that it uses in order to backtrace and punish those who use the internet to disseminate dissident points of view. A lot of their bloggers end up being sent to their logi work, rehabilitation through labor camps. And in the build-up to the Olympics, there's been a lot of talk in these unofficial circles of Chinese online dissent about dissidents being rounded up and punished preemptively so that they don't cause cause a great deal of trouble during the build-up to the Olympics. Of course, right now, China's got its hands full dealing with this horrible earthquake that claimed 76,000 lives. It's interesting, by the way, in the light of what happened in the earthquake, China, the Chinese regime, has very graciously suspended the one-child policy with respect to people who lost their children in that earthquake. That says a lot about that government, by the way. It says that they regard people as commodities that are to be manufactured and disposed of as the state sees fit, just as if you're talking about a state-run factory putting in orders for widgets or aircraft or automobiles. That's how they look on people. You know, there's a lot more where they come from. It's not a matter of losing an irreplaceable human being, a son or a daughter. It's a question of simply losing something that's a commodity regulated by the state. So, if you want to have another, we'll permit you to do so. It's really quite a repellently fascinating spectacle that's not getting anywhere near as much attention as it deserves. But if you take a look at the people who are building the surveillance technology, including the online surveillance technology for the Chinese government, it's being used to keep a lid on dissent and activism in that country. They're the same people building the same system here in the United States by a different name to carry out a slightly different set of priorities. But those priorities are not so terribly different that they would merge comfortably with what the Chinese commissars are up to.
Well, I think really, what we have to do is point out to the American people that it was the American State Department that brought the communists to power back in 1949 by putting an arms embargo on the nationalist Chinese so they couldn't buy weapons anywhere in the world. And even the weapons they'd already bought and purchased on Okinawa and other Pacific Islands were forbidden to them. And, of course, even though our Congress voted $125 million, which was a lot of money in those days, you know, for weapons for the nationalist Chinese, the State Department kept those ships in ports in San Francisco and Los Angeles for a year and a half. And when the weapons finally arrived and they broke open the cases of rifles, they didn't have any bolts in them, and they were useless. We brought communists into China, and until the American people understand that, they can't understand why our government is doing everything they can to build up communist China today, while the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the Asian bank, import bank, the export-import bank, American banks, American corporations are being encouraged to go to communist China. They've been given special tax breaks where they don't have to pay American income tax or very little American income tax if they move over there. All this is being done by our State Department to create the best enemy money could buy. And until people understand that, nothing really makes sense.
One thing about that whole corrupt process that cannot be repeated too often is the fact that that really was the meal ticket for a lot of the people who are at the top of the political pyramid right now. Go look at the history of the Bush family, for instance. Prescott Bush was deeply involved in a lot of the nastiness, corporate nastiness, that helped build up the Nazis before World War II. If you take a look at the legacy of George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, they're very tight with the Saudis. The Saudis, of course, are the ones who underwrite and promote Wahhabist Islam, revolutionary Islam of, I think, this is my theory, and it may not be worth much, but I think that the Wahhabi strain of Islam is the equivalent of the revolutionary theology type approach to Christianity that the Illuminists were promoting in the 1700s, and you saw a similar strain of perverted Judaism being promoted as well, as Rabbi Antelman has pointed out in his two-volume set, To Eliminate the Opiate. I believe that Wahhabism was the equivalent doctrine that was being promoted for the Islamic religion. And the Saudis, of course, are the ones who have been underwriting it and promoting most of the really radical people who, of course, received a lot of funding directly from the CIA, a lot of materialists as well. And that was, of course, the Bush family's very storied set of chums over there in the Saudi Peninsula. If you take a look at Dick Cheney, you've got somebody who's a perfect example of this type of capitalist, corporatist, really, that Adam Smith referred to in The Wealth of Nations as the man of system, somebody who profits through politics rather than productivity, somebody who makes his fortune not by providing the consumers with goods and services that they can use, but somebody who makes his profits by serving the interests of governments. That's how Dick Cheney became a multimillionaire, with Halliburton and all the rest of that fully panoplied corporate nonsense that he was involved in, much of it being subsidized by the Export-Import Bank and that whole nest of three-letter and four-letter agencies you referred to earlier.
It's interesting that the recent book that just came out by Scott McClellan talks about how Dick Cheney was really running things behind the scenes in the White House.
Exactly.
Imagine that. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment. Our guest has been William Grigg. Hope you enjoy William. He's with us every Friday evening at this time. But a very unusual and unique look at what's really going on behind the scenes that you're not going to get through the controlled media. Well, William, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, I would urge our listeners, once again, when you're taking time to luxuriate in the novels of Dean Koontz or John Grisham that talk about conspiracy, to examine contemporary events using the same narrative framework, if you will, that are used in these novels. When you're watching Law & Order, CSI, when you're going to a movie theater and watching something like Absolute Power, for instance, or The Firm, or The Pelican Brief, where conspiracies are being dissected and our heroes are being driven into back alleys to find out what's really going on, take a brief span of time, maybe a few days if you have it, to examine contemporary events that you read about in the newspaper or watch about on the television news, and examine what's going on using the same perspective. Do it in a way that is informed by the fact that, as our founding fathers understood, government is, always has been, if it's emancipated from law, a conspiracy against the interests and the very persons of the governed. That's not in any way a seditious or libelous or even an unreasonable way of describing it. That's the perspective of our founding fathers. That's how Madison viewed government. That's how Jefferson certainly did. Thomas Paine, George Mason, even Washington, Stern and somewhat puritanical figure, they all understood that if you emancipate government from the rule of law, it becomes a criminal conspiracy against the interests of the governed. That goes all the way back to St. Augustine, as a matter of fact. But I just, once again, find it interesting how, really, no man is a hypocrite in his pleasures, as we're told. Our American public devours for pleasure books and other entertainment about conspiracy. In other words, there's something about conspiracy that makes sense to them. I certainly wish they would dwell upon that a little bit more and act upon what they would learn once they applied that approach to assessing current events.
Well, I really think there's very little question at all that there was a conspiracy involved with 911. After all,
sure.
The government tells us that there were, you know, these 19 Arab hijackers who conspired to take down the building. That was a conspiracy. That is the government's conspiracy theory. Is it valid? And I would like to suggest it's really not very valid, because, of course, we know that within just a few hours after the attack on the World Trade Center, the government knew the name, identity, even had pictures of all those people. Within, you saw that in the New York Times, within 48 to 72 hours. Amazing that our FBI could have been so incompetent. They had no idea what was going to happen, yet they knew who all the people were within 3 days. That is truly amazing.
We thought how that works, isn't it?
Thank you so very much for being with us. We'll look forward to talking to you again.
God bless.
Goodbye. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We hope you enjoyed that William's commentary because it's always elucidating, and I think he's absolutely right. There is a conspiracy out there, and of course, many times people write about it in fiction. One of the, of course, my favorites is Rainbow Six by Tom Clancy. You can still get it, and of course, he explains to you population control, sustainable development. That's Rainbow Six by Tom Clancy, a book every American should read and reread and reread. As Tom Clancy says in the opening paragraph, you know, there's information in this book that is true that the government doesn't want you to know. And that's really very true. The last thing they want you to know is understand that there really is an agenda to kill off most of the people in this world. And it is being fostered by people at the highest levels of our government. And many of them work for the Federal Drug Administration that are releasing drugs that are deadly and, of course, are suppressing effective treatments for cancer, etc. Well, that's a whole different program. Let me simply mention that we carry a four-tape set called The Economic Hitman. It's interviews with John Perkins, who wrote Confessions of an Economic Hitman, but the book is out of print. However, we do carry another book by John Perkins called The Secret History of the American Empire. That's The Secret History of the American Empire. And then, of course, we actually have Operation Northwood, this top secret government plan to actually simulate, they were going to blow up John Glenn's rocket to try to mobilize the people against Adolf Hitler, against Fidel Castro, or sink some of our ships, or shoot down some of our planes and blame it on Fidel Castro so we could justify attacking Fidel Castro back in 1962. Operation Northwood, you can get a copy of that in our syllabus entitled Iraq, the Untold Story. That's Iraq, the Untold Story, but you need to get the DVD that goes with that as well. Or you can also get Operation Northwood by itself, but you might as well get it in the syllabus. And then, of course, we carry a book called The Ron Paul Revolution. The Ron Paul Revolution. The things that Congressman Paul has been saying in Washington, D.C. for many years that most people have never heard because, of course, anything he says is blacked out by the controlled media. And one reason they want to get rid of YouTube is because very often you'll find Congressman Paul's commentary on YouTube. And the last thing they want is for the American people to hear the truth about what's really going on. So, again, we carry the book The Secret History of the American Empire by John Perkins, a four-tape set called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. We carry Operation Northwood. We suggest you get that in the Iraq, the Untold Story syllabus, but you can get Operation Northwood by itself, and then the Ron Paul Revolution. And then, of course, we do hope that you'll get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, the book or the CD, or get them both, along with the tape is the Brotherhood of Darkness special. That you want to get our talk on the forbidden secret and the syllabus that goes with that. My talk on the planned police state and, of course, the syllabus that goes with that. You want to get the material we have on concentration camps, the video America behind Bob Wire, or Bob Wire over America, I think is the exact title. And then, of course, you'll want to get the amazing clips, which will show you the Iran-Contra hearings where Congressman Jack Brooks tries to bring out the plan for the establishment of a dictatorship in America. And, of course, he's repeatedly interrupted by Senator Inouye because the last thing they want is for the American people to learn the truth about what's being planned. Then we have a four-tape set on concentration camps. Or you can get the whole, all this material and much more in what's known as the Concentration Camp Special. And we want you to get this information out to other people's hands. We need your help to reach others. Now, remember, we have almost over 60 now outlets every single week. It's an expensive proposition. Our Saturday program alone goes to 35 stations. But quite frankly, we need your help. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family or help us in any way, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage is RadioLiberty.com. You can go there. You can click on to listen live and listen, of course, to programs 9 hours a day. That's 4 hours of live programming. And then, of course, our MP3, our archive programs, our other programs for your iPod. And then please pray for America. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.
were tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
Afternoon. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of Yah's creation. Well, guess what, folks? Take a deep breath. It's Friday. It is the 30th of May, 2008. I can't believe that June is almost upon us. Unbelievable. Well, folks, I hate to use the three words, I told ya so,